Welcome to Hot Breath Comedy Fam. On Monday, May 13th, I am teaching a clean comedy workshop. The last four I have taught sold out very quickly. So if you want to learn about clean comedy, the business side, where the line is, how to write clean comedy, go to the link in the description of this episode and we'll see you there.
What's goody, Hot Breathiverse? Welcome back to Hot Breath, the show where you learn comedy from the pros. I am your host and comedian, Joel Byers, and our guest today is a living success story of following your instincts and remaining authentic throughout the entire journey. He actually moved to New York to pursue musical theater, ended up in comedy where he was doing glamorous shows at 2 a.m. while people were trying to pay their bills. He had a booker tell him his show was too one-man showy. He had a manager tell him to change his name. But fortunately for us, through all of that, he only listened to himself. And now he has become one of the fastest rising comedians, not just on social media, but in comedy clubs, soon to be theaters, and beyond. Welcome to the Hot Breathiverse, the one and only Gianmarco Sorrazy.
Perfect.
I was really working that one today. I was like rehearsing it, like, don't say Scorsese. Don't say Scorsese.
Yeah, people do it on stage, and I just say, oh, if my last name was Scorsese, I wouldn't be performing at this shithole. That's kind of my... That's my line.
Well, welcome to the show. Thanks for doing this.
Thanks for having me. I'm honored to be on it.
Because you literally just flew in. Like, you're not even unpacked yet, and you're doing this.
Yes, yeah, it's a one-nighter. Yeah. So that's all I got. But no, it's I feel fancy. I feel more famous than I am.
You don't feel famous?
No, I don't think anyone feels famous.
Oh.
I don't know. There's moments where people stop you on the street, and it's weird. They go, so I've had someone said, are you from the internet? And I'm so awkward about it because I think on stage I like to be like kind of a prick, but I'm very polite in real life. I'm not saying I'm a good person, but I'm very like polite. I'm very non-confrontational. So I always worry that I'm going to shatter the illusion. Mm-hmm. Someone came up and they said like, oh my God, I'm a big fan of your work. If they came up, they said, are you Gianmarco? And I was like, oh yeah. And they said, oh, I'm a big fan of your work. And I was like, thank you so much. I appreciate it. And I like talked like that and loud, and it was weird. And I just imagined them going like, I met that guy. He was weird. He was weird.
But for someone like, for me, a comedian who sees someone like you with hundreds of thousands of followers, you're like selling tickets, you're on the road, like selling to an actual fan base. I guess for someone like me, I was like, oh, he's doing it. He's doing what we're trying to do.
I think that's certainly what I can see how I could like look at that from the outside. And I'm doing things, but I think especially when you're touring, you go places and you go, oh, if you saw the show I did in Ottawa, the second show that we added on Wednesday night for 15 people, it's less glamorous than it seems. Mm-hmm. There's always, with all comedy, there's always like the next level up, and you see the people selling out weekends. And, you know, I'm doing a one-nighter Atlanta. Everyone kept saying, come to Atlanta. I haven't sold it out yet. I don't think I will.
There's still time.
Yeah. Can we release this now? Yeah. Can we live stream this now? No, it's all fine. But I'm just saying, like, when you're on the road, you are experiencing a wide, oh my God, that's how wide. It's that big, a wide range of failure and success.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, for you and the output you have on social media, it's mind-blowing for me who's trying to be consistent online, and literally every time I open the app, you're there. Mm-hmm. What is happening? Are you just always posting? Do you have someone that helps you with this now?
Oh, so many people that help. I still do more than I want to, but uh-huh. They're tough reins to hand over. I think it's just a real balance of the podcast. Part of that is like a clip generator. It's every week I get two or three new clips. Mm-hmm. Then I do my, you know, crowd work. I have my person who helps me caption. I have the person who helps edit. And I wake up every morning since, you know, middle of the pandemic, my morning spent hour and a half just posting on all the various platforms, whatever it is that day. I have my own little system. TikTok, I'll post fucking anything. If it bombs on there, then I won't post it somewhere else. So it's never ending.
So that's what you do. You're still hitting like the post button.
Yes.
And all that. Yeah.
Yes, I'm working to have someone help, But then the moment they do something strange, you go, it's like someone speaking for you. And you go like, that's not me. What are you talking about? So it's hard. I feel like you can see when people's social media gets run poorly or run by another company because it becomes so impersonal.
Yeah.
There's one comic, I don't even remember his name, but he posted an image of him with a pecan. It was like, it said, pecan pie or pumpkin pie? Sound off in the comments. And I was like, that is where it can go, where it's just like, it's just engagement farming. Yeah. And it's so stupid and gross. And maybe it works, but I can't.
Yeah.
I can't do that.
Well, some people are saying that about crowd work, though. Of like, oh, I can't.
Sure.
It's cheap or whatever.
I get it. I get all the critiques of crowd work. I think when I see crowd work on showcase shows, I think it's obnoxious. Mm. I think it changes the tone of the room. I can absolutely see comedians giving poor sets so they can get one clip out of it. And I've seen a host, I swear to God, find out the job of every fucking person in the room in the hopes of finding something. I think it's bad in the sense that you're not living for the people in the room. You're performing for a clip. I think there's a balance to be had. I think crowd work should be saved for headliners and hosts. I don't think showcase shows should have a lot of crowd work. Some people do it professionally. That's great. But it fucks up a show. It fucks up a show. It changes the vibe. It makes the audience too chatty. And a lot of people are posting mediocre crowd work. I sometimes slip. And sometimes you have to be like, you know what? I didn't get anything from that show.
Yeah.
I can try to edit the shit out of this to make it as if I got something, but you didn't. There's no beginning, middle, end. There's no punchline. So it's bad. It's a scourge, but I have no other choice. And I like it. It's fun.
And it's working.
It can be fun to do.
Right.
It keeps me alive, keeps me on my toes.
Yeah.
But it definitely is a problem.
What advice do you have for crowd work for a comic listening who's like, well, I'd like to do it better?
I do not consider myself a great crowd worker, let me just say. Mm-hmm. I think when I do good crowd work, I feel like, okay, I'm decent at this. And then sometimes I have some nights where I'm like, I think I'm the worst crowd work person in the world. I listened recently to your episode with Ian Bagg because someone referenced it somewhere else. And I was like, let me see what Ian has to say. This is the guy who does it for real. But as someone told me recently, like, you got to be a journalist. You got to, like, in my notes, I always am like, you have to drive the conversation. You have to take swings. You have to make leaps. Sometimes I feel like I rely on them to give me something. And then if they're not an engaging audience member, or if they're weird or quiet or slow, then it goes nowhere. So I have to really lead them. If you ask so many open-ended questions, what do you do for work? How do you like that? What's something that bad that happened at work? That it gives them the opportunity to not give a good answer. They feel put on the spot. But if I'm like, oh, at work, does a boss ever catch you looking at your phone while you're picking up the nuclear reactor thing? Like, you got to give them something. And it's a mix of like really being curious and inquisitive, but also I think making leaps and getting them on your wavelength as opposed to going off of theirs.
Yeah, it's tough to not like force it either, like to where you're like, all right, I'm doing crowd work, all right, I'm trying to now manufacture a moment that I can then replicate onto social media. But it sounds like there has to be like an authentic
like
conversation happening here.
But you got to dig in the right way. And this is where whenever I feel like I'm bad at crowd work, it's always like I asked a question that it felt like it moved away from the funny, or it gave me info that's not useful. Mm. You got to like find where the interesting point of view is and then keep digging into that realm. The one crowd work thing that I feel like I did, Earthquake has a radio show on Sirius XM.
Yes.
Quake's House or something like that. And I was very nervous. I was very nervous. I never met Earthquake, but I consider him like a legendary comic.
For sure.
And we were talking about this earlier. I was the only white guy in this space. And there were older comics and they were friends. And like, my agent was his agent. And so I was there. And, you know, that's the only reason I'm there. I haven't earned it, nothing. And it was 2 p.m., and I'm not a drinker for professional things, but I started drinking vodka because I was so nervous. And I remember we were going around introducing ourselves, and there was a guy there. His, like, moniker is, I'm the alpha dog of comedy. And then he got to me, and I said, oh, I'm Gianmarco. I'm the beta dog of comedy. And their reaction was like, what the fuck? Like, I think whenever you play a black room, like, the self-deprecation is not always viewed the same way as other spaces. There's a degree of like, what? You're shitting on yourself?
Yeah.
Come on, have some pride.
Yeah.
And so my lesson from that, though, is I finally got in there. Like, I established myself as a white comic does in these spaces often, as like, I established myself as like the Jew. Mm-hmm. Like, if you were to look at like Wild and Out, they have a Jewish guy on there now. I forget his name, but he's like, you know, the Jew on the show. He has a big yarmulke.
Yeah, that's
his
name.
He's bald so that you can just see the yarmulke perfectly. I don't think that was a choice. This is what he is. But kosher Dills. And basically, we got on some kind of riff about who knows what. I think it was about like men who go back to prison constantly. Does that mean they have a boyfriend on the inside? This is all stuff like, It's not my topic. There's a little bit of a whiff, more than a whiff of homophobia to the whole situation. And I started getting on some run, and like I do, I thought of one good joke, and that was it. And Earthquake looked over, and this wasn't filmed, and he looked at me, he was like, keep going. And it was that thing where like, I didn't have another great joke, but I kept going. I said another line that, looking back on, wasn't that funny, but then the next line was funny. And I think a lot about, with crowd work, like, it takes a degree of confidence. Mm. You have to make it seem like you do have a plan, or this is leading somewhere, even if you don't. And then you have to keep going, trusting that something funny is going to be on the other side. And in my notes, like at the top of my little document of looking over what jokes I want to do that night, there is that note from Earthquake of just like, keep going, push further, even if I'm nervous that at the end of this interaction, there's nothing funny.
Yeah. I had that experience recently. Well, I was actually the casino shows that I was talking about before we started filming. And I'm working out about cereal. So I just asked, I was like, what are y'all favorite cereal? And then someone would say one. And I would try to say something funny, and then someone else would say one, and I would try to say something funny, and then it ended up with a lady saying, have you ever put ice in your milk? And so it ended up from like talking about cereal to then like, oh, here's a personal thing that people may or may not relate to.
Yeah.
So it's continuing, but it really didn't lead anywhere that great. I cut up into a crowd work clip, we'll see. I have a good habit of cutting up something and then never hitting post. Getting pretty good at that. Yeah.
Just because you're like, it's not good enough?
I
think it's good. I think it's good discipline. We all have to make decisions sometimes where we edit and we go, you know what? No.
Yeah.
I mean, you got to do it. You sometimes have to say no, and it's tough.
Because you feel that pressure of like, well, everyone's posting and blowing up on crowd work, and this is what we got to do. But
not everyone's into crowd work, and there's sometimes I feel like I don't want to do it, and certain spaces don't lend itself to it. I see some guys that move to theaters, and the crowd work clips start losing something. And it's just because the distance and you're, what do you do? What did you say? Like, it's not the same.
Right, yeah.
I work Helium, and the little room sometimes, they're so great for crowd work. And I'm like, I'll just get my clips here and then go somewhere else. So it's a balance.
Yeah.
It's a balance. But I do fear that everyone's just going to lean into crowd work. And I have people sometimes will write like, is this show going to be a lot of crowd work? Huh. And I think some people want it and some people don't. And some people loathe the idea of the comedian talks to them. They hate it. So I don't know.
And you're like, a lot of your clips are known as like, it's getting buzz from the crowd work. Are your shows becoming more disruptive? Are people like having the assumption?
No, I haven't had that. I haven't had that experience. Once in a while, an audience member would be like, oh, I thought you were going to like roast us more, or as if I was going to hit the whole audience. And I've heard people who do a lot of crowd work clips that like their shows have become all crowd work. But I think I set the tone pretty early on that this is a material show.
Good.
Unless
okay,
I
cool.
say otherwise.
Yeah, I just heard, maybe it was Nate Bargatze talking of like, yeah, I mean, you can do crowd work, but he's like you said, when you get to like a theater or like you're not doing Madison Square Garden and you're doing crowd work, you got to have an act to back this up. But with young comics, I can't imagine how long have you been doing comedy?
I say like 8 years.
8 years?
Eight, maybe nine.
So, I mean, I can't imagine like being young now at open mics and then feeling like, oh, I have to figure out how to say a joke and I have to figure out how to edit and do crowd work and like all this. It's like there's so many different variables now.
Yeah, and I think I certainly see a lot of comics who they do jokes and crowd. Like in the beginning, I was just doing jokes for sure. It was just jokes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you try to learn these two skills at the same time, often with a lot of comics, their material is soft and they always will pivot into the crowd work, or they'll pivot when it doesn't work, or they don't have the struggle of, okay, if I'm not going to do crowd work, can I somehow with the jokes win the audience back?
Yeah.
And like sometimes you're in a situation where you have to do that, you know? And so I think it's tough to learn two skills at once. And stand up is just, I always think like roast battles taught me joke writing. And part of that is the scope is very limited of what you can do with you can't do crowd work in a roast battle.
Mm-hmm.
You could maybe do improv, but like roast battles are generally about just tight jokes. And your point of view is just to insult the other person in a way that gets a big pop. And I feel like I learned what makes sense for me writing jokes from that narrow medium.
Yeah.
But if I were to just be doing showcase shows and kind of doing crowd work and kind of doing jokes, it's hard to know if I'd ever master any of them.
Yeah, that is smart to like think of it as learning one thing at a time. So like learning jokes first and then building an act, then you can start to kind of get a little more flexible with the crowd work, I think is a good foundation to have. Because I think when I started with one-liners like early on and then got longer winded from there, but it all started with learning how to set up, how to punchline misdirect, and just kind of learning the fundamentals and then starting to make it your own.
Yeah, yeah. I also think there's another thing with some crowds, if you do just jokes, this is the problem with it. I think some comedy clubs will eventually be like, hey, no more crowd work. Because I think you can't expect comedians to be moderating themselves. And one day some booker is going to see a show and see everyone do crowd work for 10 minutes and go, what the fuck is this? You know what? Turn off the fucking cameras. No more filming at this. Because I always thought like, oh, these comedy clubs are so foolish. So many didn't have cameras for so long. And it was like the advertising you're getting. Every comedian is posting these clips that are going viral. You're getting insane free advertising.
Mm-hmm.
And now I go, you know what? Maybe it's detrimental because now every comedian is using your space to boost their own social media, and they no longer care about giving the best show that they can.
Is there something you found that works better than other than like posting? Are you trying to talk about certain topics that you know are going to pop off better on social media? Is there like a strategy behind the
only
content?
In the beginning, I think like I don't think I'm disciplined or I get too bored to like, I think I could really force myself to think of even more divorce material than I already have and just become divorce boy or depression boy, or I certainly have a lot of Jewish material, but I think it's just whatever funny thought pops in my head.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really have much ability to just drill on one subject. And I find a lot of people who focus very niche topics, they become mediocre comics quickly.
But those are the kind of the identifying topics that could maybe take off on social media of like, oh, that's that comedian.
Sure. And I feel like in the beginning of TikTok, when I first started, and I always told people, my advice was always like, if you're Chinese, do some jokes about being Chinese because that will click in with the target. For me, it was like Italians clicked with a market, Jewish clicked with market, divorce, and theater kid.
Mm-hmm.
Those were the markets.
Yeah.
And I didn't choose them. That's just, that was my like things. And so I just made sure those jokes are really tight and I posted them earlier than later. But that's what I say to first break in. I mean, that's the really tough part. If you're from the South, lean into the South. And then some people go further. Some people, they become, you know, that's my character on stage. Mm. I don't want to do that. And I don't think I could write really good material if I just made it all Jewy stuff. or all Italian stuff. I wasn't even raised that Italian, so it only goes so deep.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think also now we're having to like diversify skill sets as well. I mean, being a stand-up, people see that and then they're like, well, what else can you do?
Sure.
Like you have podcasts, people do sketches and things. It's like, I mean, we're our own media company now, so we have to figure out all the different almost programming we have that are us.
Yeah. Yeah, there can sometimes feel like being good at stand-up is not the priority at any point. And that can be annoying. But I think if you get really good, you know, to a degree, the cream rises to the top. Some shit rises to the top, too.
Mm-hmm.
But the cream joins the shit. And then they do each other's podcast and pretend that they respect each other.
So actually, something in researching you that I wasn't able to find is the transition from moving to New York, pursuing musical theater, and then the next thing I hear, you're doing 2 a.m. shows for the Check Drop. I was never able to find, like, what is that kind of tipping point of, like, oh, I'm a comedian now.
Yeah. So I had dabbled in that. I did a class when I was in college for musical theater. I did a summer in New York where I took a class at Caroline's Comedy Club, which was, like, it was just interesting. Like, you learn a little bit, but the class is, moreover, it's, like, in 7 weeks, you're going to do 5 minutes on stage. And, you know, I would say that I was the best in that class, which is there's no trophies to be given for that. But there was enough there to be like, oh, interesting, there's something here. And then I like went back to school and I did an hour. And it was just like, it wasn't a good hour,
but
it was just like and because I was an actor, and did playwriting, I just wrote everything out. And I basically, this was probably the filthiest hour I've ever written. It was just about like every time I'd ever had sex and the time a girl peed on me and the time I came too fast. Like that was the hour. And in my mind, I was like, I'm also a stand-up. Like the kind of thing I would not hate now, but I'd be like, okay. I was an actor and I did stand-up and I did like a bringer show once a year. And you would do these bringers with new material, but it would be a sold out crowd, white hot. And I would do decently, and I'd be like, I'm good at this.
Right.
And then I think I did like 2 mics at the Creek in the Cave where I would do the material that crushed on the show, and it wouldn't work at all. And the Creek in the Cave at this point, it was like very bro-y. It was just not the kind of man that it felt weird. It felt like no one was paying attention. And so in my head, I was like, oh, this is truly the thought. Oh, my act just works better for sold out rooms. But like you justify it in your head.
Yeah, of course.
And then I just didn't do it for a long time, maybe once a year. And I wrote a play for this thing called the Fringe Festival, which used to be a big indie festival in New York. A lot of shows came in, like the Edinburgh Fringe, but not quite as big. And it was autobiographical, and it had a lot of talking to the audience. And it had a lot of this, like, sort of stand-up that I did. And I made it a little tighter. And all the positive feedback was kind of for those parts. And, like, when you tell jokes in theater, the bar is a lot lower. The same way that, like, someone will look at, like, a one-person show and be like, this wouldn't work in a comedy club. But in the theater space, it's very funny.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I just got a lot of feedback from people being like, I liked where you talked to the audience. And I had a friend named Lindsay Elizabeth Hand, who was a producer friend. We worked together a lot. And she like was like, you should focus on this. And like really, really like told it to me with like a degree of emotion where I was like, oh, you're really serious. You really like think this. So I just dove in. I think I went to like those roast battles. Fucking bombed terribly. Like I had to. I mean, I really. That the beginning is the worst. I just going up and I would kind of like be a little bit like nervous and a little bit of like a character, and the jokes were shit, and I approached it like an actor. Like I basically wrote so many jokes and ideas, and I had a friend named Kevin Labeson who was an artistic director at the People's Improv Theater, and I basically paid him to meet up, and I would just read the jokes out loud, And he would be like, yeah. And it was like, it was, I don't think a lot of stand-ups go about it that way. But I do it today with, I have a friend, Alice Grindling, who I call basically an hour once a week. And I just say jokes. And she's a good laugher. And I just base it off that. I like to just work through words that I've written down. And that's just how I started. I started going out nights, which I'd never done before. I was kind of a recluse, a homebody. And I think the real turn was I started working at LOL Comedy Club, which is like the worst comedy club in the world. And I was seeing a comic at the time, and like all comedy clubs, it's hard to get into. It's hard to find the right moment. And she said to the booker, hey, I'm fucking this guy. Can you please let him audition? Dude. And she was like, okay. And I was like theatrical enough and have been doing it long enough that like I did well for that space. And I just got to do check spots. And I was willing to do like every check spot. And I really do feel like, and maybe I'm wrong in retrospect, but I feel like I did every check spot there for a year and a half. So it was at least 20, 24 spots a week. And at the time, LOL had three rooms, which no comedy, I mean, the Cellar has it now, but like no comedy club would you work every single show. Mm-hmm. And I just did, you know, four check spots a night on the weekdays and then six on the weekends with shows that would start at one. And sometimes very hot audiences, not smart audiences in general. It's a mix of folks. Some people who can't speak English fully, drunk, just looking for a place to get stoned and drink. And I just learned a lot from just doing that. I got more stage time than I don't know anywhere I could get that kind of stage time anymore.
Wow.
In not even there. LOL, they lost that space and now they operate out of an even worse space.
But the reps, like just that repetition, like every after interviewing over 400 comics on here, the number one piece of advice has been you have to get on stage. Like,
sure,
getting on stage is everything. So the fact you're able to get those reps in basically the trenches of comedy.
But that's a perfect place of like, if I had been crowd worky then, I would not have learned what I learned. Because it's like a perfect space for crowd work. I mean, you can do the classic, you two fucking and you'll get a pop. And I just didn't do crowd work then. It was just, I didn't like talking to people. It was so anxiety inducing. And then eventually I had to host there, and that's where I started to learn a little bit of crowd work. But even then, not, you know, hosting is scarier than anything I have to do.
Oh, really?
If I have to host, I'm more nervous about that than to headline.
I don't mind. I mean, I don't like hosting anymore, but like, I feel like the bar is lower for hosting because like you're kind of there just to set the vibe. You don't necessarily have to like kill. You just have to set an environment.
Sure, but I want to kill.
But that's why.
Like, yeah. I agree. And I always, you know, whenever I'm having a rougher set or if I do have to host, I'm like, I remember when I saw the host and I knew that it was a cold crowd and I wasn't judging them for this. But in my mind, in the moment, I'm like, every comic is going, wow, he fucking sucks. He didn't go up there and just immediately blow up the room. So yeah, I worked at LOL for like an insanely long amount of time. To my detriment in the degree that like I don't think I socialized with a lot of like comics my age for a while. There's some comics my age there, but there's some older comics who just have kind of like settled at LOL. That's just where they're going to work. Or who have dreams and whatnot, but LOL is a place you can get stuck. And also not being paid for that entire time is like pretty egregious. I got paid eventually, but even then it was shit.
Yeah, of course.
And but I just got these crazy reps in. And there were some comics there that were fantastic. There was a comic named Ken Boyd, who I know he does a lot of cruises now, but like his charisma and his ability to mime on stage was astounding. And I feel like I took a lot from him. The way that he always felt joy, even if he was faking it, but like he always like looked like he was having the time of his life up there. And I feel like I borrowed a lot. I feel like there were a lot of black comics at that club. Like, I think if I started in like Brooklyn or other spaces that weren't as diverse, I could have like easily become like kind of a different kind of comic maybe, but I was theatrical. I am big. When I get anxious, I become bigger. I become louder. I gesture. And in black clubs, I feel like that theatricality is still loved.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas like there's Brooklyn Spaces or the one club at the time, it was New York Comedy Club, where the booker said I was too one-man show, where it was like, that's not the thing we're doing anymore. And in a way, it was good to be in that space where I felt like the style I was doing was embraced and I was seeing other comics being big, because then I could at least be a little bit more authentic to myself and then fine tune from there.
How do you find your authenticity? I feel like when I feel like I'll set intentions, because I headline now, and I was like, sometimes I'll go out and be like, all right, I'm setting the intention. I'm going to have fun. I'm going to be Silly Goose and Lucy. But then like sometimes I'll still kind of just like kind of retreat back or whatnot. It's like,
yeah, you can't control it. I mean, you can't make it 100% every time. I just try to remind myself that like, if I'm not digging it, why would anyone else get on board? But it's tough. I mean, when I had a Don't Tell taping earlier this year, and like I tried to be in a good space for it, and then the audience just like didn't dig my first joke, which was like a harsh open, but it didn't work. And I just could feel inside just like wanting to be like, all right, let's just call it. Fuck. And I'd flown to LA like for this taping, and I mean, I collapsed on stage, and I still like got through it, and we ended up cutting a chunk, and the set went great, and it did well. But I was weeping the next day in a Delta lounge to my poor put upon girlfriend, being like, I fucking, this is all I do, and I can't fucking do a good 10-minute set on Don't Tell.
Well, dude, watching the set on YouTube, it's undeniable.
It's great
killer.
Editing work, but I. Yeah, you try to be in a good place, but sometimes you're just not. It's a very weird feeling headlining sometimes, especially as you get more people coming out for you, where like, if I'm in a shit mood, whether from travel or personal things, and then I get there and I see there's people who hired babysitters and who this is their moment this week, this month, and I go, I am in such a bad mood, this is so unfair to them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the reason I do stand up is if I start getting those laughs on stage like a drug, which it is
for sure,
it boosts me back up, and I will get in a good mood surprisingly fast if the jokes start hitting.
Gotcha.
But everyone has bad, you can't always get in that mindset.
I didn't know if you, coming from a theater background, if there were like techniques that you can kind of like prime yourself for performance.
Yeah, I'm not doing like emotional memory exercises of when I was happy, when my parents still spoke to each other, like, oh. But I definitely think some people don't know how to fake anything. And I know how to fake it. I know how to come out there and be like, hey, everybody. And I know some comics who like can't seem to go, if they're here, that's what it's gonna be. And it's like, God bless.
Mm-hmm.
But some rooms, that's gonna be tough. But yeah, LOL, which I shit on more publicly now, I feel very comfortable about it because I felt so mistreated by them for so long. But it really was my home base. And I always feel weird. I always wonder how regular people view, whenever you use the term like a black club, you can say urban club.
Yeah.
But it's not what comics say. It's just always weird. It's always weird to talk about it, because I'm always like, don't say urban club. That's you're putting on a phony version of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But like, it captures a general spirit of like a certain kind of room, and where you just say Def Jam. You could just say a Def Jam.
But even like when you said black room, I was like, oh no, do I need to add context that I came up in the black rooms here in Atlanta? You've done black rooms, like, we're not coming from a place of like being derogatory, but like we've performed in a lot of these rooms.
Yeah.
We're not trying to like segregate comedy in any way, but it's actually a lot of comedy.
Yeah, that's what
is
the
segregated.
Bookers are doing. It's not us.
A lot of
we're
comedy
not the
is
ones
segregated.
Segregating comedy.
Yeah.
But
and they book people like us. Yeah. But I felt, even when, like, when you said that, I was like, oh no, do I need to make sure people listening know we're coming from a place of, like, professional experience here, and not like, oh, black rooms versus white rooms type deal.
Sure.
But
I could see a, yeah.
We can clip there's, it out
No, 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 yeah. Please, no, don't clip it out. No, no, I think it's important it's important to, like, figure out a way to, like, actually talk the way that people actually talk in the real world rather than pretend.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes I feel like the term urban club is, like, worse because it's just, like, it's just, like, it's a fake thing. I don't know that you're trying to say. But, yeah, it just describes a space where, like, as opposed to, like, a Brooklyn room, which you could call a white club mm-hmm. in the sense that there's, like, a certain – there's a vibe, and it's more low, and it's more like, oh, here's a witty line.
Ironic,
and here's a – I've always said, like – because I lived in Harlem for a long time. And between that and LOL, like, I felt like I performed in spaces where there weren't that many white comics going up. And I think there's just, like, different stereotypes about each type of thing. In Brooklyn, it can be very self-deprecating. But, like, in a Harlem room, the same way as being on Earthquake show, like, my feeling is if you were to make a joke about how small your dick was, people in the room would be like, what do you – dude, there's women here. Why are you telling them you have a small dick? Fucking – for me, Bernie Mac – on Def Jam going, I ain't scared of you motherfuckers, to me embodies the spirit of, like, that's what the room calls for. It calls for a kind of confidence.
Yes.
And just a kind of owning the stage.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, if you go to, I think what UCB probably led to, there's a degree of, like, people give you the attention out of turn, and then you can play with that in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
In Harlem, you got to earn it.
You have to go up there
and prove within seconds. I mean, it's the Apollo mind. It's the Apollo thing. You will be booed if that first joke doesn't fucking land.
But you've got to be authentic too. I think that's what I found in performing in black rooms is, like, they want you to be real and actually, like, care. You can't phone it in. Like, they can sift out. They can smell anything fake, or if you're trying to be. They don't mind clever writing. Like, black rooms like writing. It doesn't have to be all boisterous, but it has to be coming from, like, an authentic place and not just from, like, a manufactured attitude because I'm ironic type deal. It's got to be coming from a real place is what I've learned.
But ultimately, I think, like, the excellent people in any room, any kind of room, will succeed in all rooms.
Yes,
I think it's rarely that, like, some excellent comic from this place will bomb over here. I don't think that's common.
Yeah.
And
that was my goal, is if I perform in front of an all-black room, I want to make sure I'm doing jokes that work in front of an all-white room or at, like, a church or, like, a college. Like, that's my mindset around material that I want to be able to translate everywhere, and if it doesn't, then I just get rid of it.
Yeah, yeah.
Or I put a funny caption on it and then post it and hashtag that demographic and exploit it for views.
Uh-huh, of course.
That's an option as well.
Of course.
But as we start to land this plane here, I appreciate you for doing this, man. This is so cool because I remember we did the show at the Comedy Store together, and I've been following you ever since. But then you just land, and you're willing to do this is very
generous. I'm honored to talk comedy. I always am.
So the question I always ask on here is, like, people's worst bombing story. Like, what's an experience you've had on stage that you just never forget that gives you the cold sweats and nightmares?
Yeah, early on, and I don't think I could do this gig well now, but early on, about a year, maybe 2 years in, it was like my uncle's sort of friend was having a bachelor party, and it was a second marriage. He was in his, I would say, 50s, and for $600, which was like, whoa, $600, could I go to, like, a private steakhouse and do 30 minutes? And in my mind, I've been doing 30 minutes, and I was like, oh, I was deep into roast battles. I was like, I will write a bunch of jokes. I'll hire a buddy of mine. I hired Matt Moran. Like, he'll write some jokes. We'll talk about the jokes. I'll write them on note cards, and I'll mix it in with material. And I even went so far as to interview his son, like his son who was 22. I met him for coffee, and I was like, so tell me about your dad. And he was like, I don't know. He's just like such a fucking idiot. And I was like, okay, good fucking idiot. And I found his Instagram. He was, like, a little bit heavy And I was like, great, there we go. That's 100 more jokes. And then, you know, his wife was like younger, second marriage. So I came with all these jokes, and I either wrote them on note cards or I literally printed them out, cut them out, pasted them on the note cards. I wore like a suit. And again, I don't know what I was, I don't know what I expected. Like I expected like this was going to be like a Friars Club roast somehow that I had gotten hired for.
Right.
And I went to the steakhouse and they brought me into the back room and it was like, it was a junky steakhouse. Everyone was wearing shorts and t-shirts and I was in like an H&M suit. And, I get there and they're seated in the round. So there's no stage. There's no mic. There's no, and I'm young. I felt so young in them. I felt like such a child. And, I get there and they're all having fun. It felt like I had forced myself upon them. And I like started to launch into my jokes and they said, let's wait for the steaks to get here. So then I'm just like standing there. I don't even think there was a chair for me. And I'm just standing kind of looking around. And I'm socially awkward, so I wasn't good at like engaging them in conversation. And they said, do you want anything to drink? And I was like, oh, I have a glass of red wine. And one said, red wine, you pussy? And everyone started laughing. And I was like, this is bad. This is bad. And the steaks came out. And I was like, great, I'll start. And they were like, hold on. Because they all got the same steak. So they had to compare to see who got medium rare, who got well done. And then finally, the birthday guy was like, begin. And very awkwardly, I have the recording. I still am a little bit overly, I talk a little bit affected, more than I want to. I want to be more natural. But back then it was like, well, Gary, welcome to this. And I started with, and some of the jokes were decent, I think. I'd done a lot of research. I worked really, I earned this money for sure. And it was like, Gary hates, he flew a lot, or he had an airplane company. It was like, Gary hates going through security because it takes so long for him to get off his belt or something. Or he liked toy airplanes. I said, Gary likes toy airplanes because they make his dick look regular size. I said, Gary, your friends say you love eating out. Well, everyone except for your fiance. And he was like, whoa, her son's right there. And I was like, oh, sorry. And then I joked about, you know, him being fat. And he, and after the second fat joke, he was like, okay, enough with the fat jokes. And I was like, enough with the fat joke? That is the whole set.
Are people laughing?
His friends were kind of laughing, but he was not. He was like not enjoying it. And it was like they were laughing. They were laughing like, oh, Gary. They weren't having fun. They were laughing in the spirit of what this was supposed to be. And he said no fat jokes. Don't talk about his fiance. And I think where I was so foolish is then I was like, oh, I'll just go into my material. And there is a moment where you hear me 5 minutes into this roast go, so I went to college for musical theater. And you're just like, why the fuck would they enjoy any of this? Me talking about being a failed actor and doing a bit where I do a tap dance and I sing a little. And it was one of those where I could see the clock and I was looking at it. And I had gone through all my note cards. Like my idea was like, I have these note cards, I go into material, when I start losing them, back to the note cards. But I couldn't do the fat jokes and I couldn't do the jokes about his fiance. And at towards the end, it was like minute 25 and I was sweating and I was walking around the table. And if I got too close to any of the guys, they'd be like, hey, back off. Give me some space.
No mic. You're just the guy walking around.
Walking around. And then I said, Donna, I think her name was Donna. Donna always dresses to the nines to make up for being a six, which is a decent joke.
Yeah.
Decent joke. And one of his friends goes, no, she's a two. A size two, that is. And that's the first joke that this motherfucker goes, ah, yes, that's what I'm talking about. We should have hired you to be the comedian. That classic line, we should have hired you to be the comedian. And I was like, wait, so the joke is your wife's skinny? That's the fucking joke you wanted? Talk about your, oh, she has big tits too. Great. And I at 26 minutes, I clocked. I said, all right, that's me. And if they hadn't paid me, they would have been in the right. But he did, and he said, good work. But I would really love, and I'm sure I could find their info somewhere, to find out what they thought. Because maybe it was so bad, and I was so awkward that it was funny what occurred.
Mm-hmm.
It could have been that level of bad. So maybe they did have a good time just joking about what the fuck was that. That's what I imagined when I left the room, that Gary turned to his best man and said, what the fuck was that? Jesus Christ. I would like to ask them. I would like to find out. But it was one of those bombs. It was so bad. First of all, I wouldn't do it again. I wouldn't do that kind of gig. Maybe $5,000, I'd consider it.
Yeah.
But probably not.
Oh, yeah.
Because it felt so awful. I called like everyone I knew to recount. Like, that's my, when I feel that kind of shame, I need to like express it with people. So I called 8 different people, like waiting at the gas station after that, just to like get it off my chest, to tell them what had happened. Because it was the shame was too much to bear on my own. And that was early. And I know what they want. I don't know if I could do what they would have wanted. I don't know what they wanted. 30 minutes is a long time for what they wanted.
For sure.
But like, they wanted like Aaron Berg. I don't know if you know, he's mm-hmm. a New York guy. Yeah, to be yeah. like, hey, you're gay. You got a small dick. And just like, he's better than that. But like, yeah. I was saying, like, they just wanted to be roasted fast by someone with confidence.
Yeah, with bravado. And you're in there like, hey.
I could try to fake it, but like, I don't know.
How long into comedy was this?
It was like a year and a half, 2 years. Oh. Still where like I had an oversized... Matthew Broussard has a great line of, I just want to be as good at comedy as I thought I was 2 years in.
Hilarious.
And I feel like I was so in that pocket of where I was like, I'm pretty good, I think.
Yeah.
And then moments like that make you go... Even now, like if I have a headlining set, I had a JCC recently. Where Jewish Community Center. I know I'm in the South. And a woman came up and she said, just so you know, I run a group for adults with severe autism, and there's about 20 of them, and we brought them to the show. They're seated in this section, just in case you notice like one section is not responding as you might normally expect. And I went up, and at some point I mentioned a friend who was gay or had a boyfriend, and one of the autistic adults went, ew, very loudly, in a way that everyone could hear. And I in the moment, I could not think of a funny way to deal with it. It's one of those moments where I should have made fun of him more than I did. Instead, I was like, well, it's okay to be gay. Like, terrible, terrible comedic impulse to teach a lesson.
Right.
And in a way where it's like, no, I could roast him a little, and people wouldn't be like, "How dare you?" I wouldn't make fun of his autism. I would make fun of him, his homophobia or whatever. Right. But when I do shows in that kind of space where it was tough, it was a tough show. And when you do an hour for a tough audience, that's where you're like, "Oh, this is why you need to be good, so you can get to the end of this without people walking out, without people like." Going heckling in an aggressive, mean way.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know those comics, many social media folks who start doing an hour, not in New York for their friends, their fans, but like who go to like a regular comedy club in Arizona and suddenly are doing an hour and the audience is tough and they just have meltdowns and feel humiliated, as they should.
As they should.
As they should.
As they should. Comedy always has a way to humble you. Like, you can get certain amount of positive momentum, and then there's going to be a show that reminds you, like, hey, not so fast.
Yeah.
Always.
Yeah.
That was the casino for me.
But that's why big comics get bad. I saw a big comic last night who I won't name, and it's like, you are just so loved. You have not been humbled in so long. You don't even stick around to see that every comic did better than you on this show.
Mm-hmm.
And it must be tough. It's got to be tough at that level to to have those kinds of bombs.
And they bombed.
No, they did fine.
But it was
they
like
did fine.
A
but
lot
their
of goodwill
love,
from the audience.
A lot of goodwill. Yeah. And it's like when you lose the capacity to like do badly in a show and remind yourself, oh, I need to work on shit, you start sucking.
But it must be tough to stay motivated if you're like, oh, I'm rich, I do arenas. Like, is this arena level act like you're talking about?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So it's, but at a certain point, like, what's the motivation beyond, like, you've got to find, like, we're up and coming, we're grinding, we're still trying to figure out and prove ourselves in a lot of ways. But it's like, oh, they prove themselves. What do they have to?
Sure, I would think the motivation would
and
be
I'm
just
not
like
giving
being
them
on
the benefit of the doubt.
No,
I'm
no,
not
no.
saying they shouldn't kill.
No,
I'm
no, no. I just think the motivation would be doing a show where someone else is better than you. And feeling that, and maybe you get older and you chill and you don't give a shit, but like I've been feeling kind of confident lately, partly because I've been working on something that's going to be taped. And so like my sets have been like really strong because I'm doing like a very fine-tuned set. And then I was at the Cellar and I saw Ricky Velez, who I'd never seen live. And like he just obliterated, and it was so different from the style that I do, and it was so like casual and felt off the cuff, but was packed with punchlines. And seeing him, I've seen Shane Gillis at the Cellar in a way that made me want to kill myself. Jeffrey Asmus, there's plenty more, but like those are three that like in my mind when I see them I go fuck. And that keeps me stronger.
It's the good part about coming up in New York. It's like iron sharpens iron in a lot of
ways.
That's
why you got. That's ultimately why I think you got to move to a place where that you're just constantly around just really good people.
Mm-hmm.
I can't be the best on a lineup at the Cellar close to every time. There's so many great comics there. Once in a while, I feel real strong. But you got to be in that space. And that's what happens sometimes when you start headlining is I'm not home as much anymore. And of course, if I'm headlining and half the room's there for me, I'm going to be the best on the lineup. But like going back to the Cellar on like a Monday and being like, oh, let's do the new jokes that I finished this weekend and go like, oh, I did not finish them.
Yeah, exactly.
I did not finish them at all. I've been lying to myself.
Well, congrats on the taping then. I mean, I guess that's what you're kind of cooking up next is you're going to be taping.
Taping, not a full. It's a thing. I can't. Why now? It's taping. It's like a 10-minute set, and I'm not allowed to say for what yet.
Mm-hmm.
But it's good.
Yeah,
that's what I'm. I was going to do a special, and then this thing came along, and now I'm like, okay, let's do this thing, and then let's work on a special. And I hate coming up with orders of jokes. I hate doing the same set every night, and it's going to be hell. It's going to be hell to make the special.
It'll pay off, though.
It'll pay off. But whenever I'm not working on new, I feel like I didn't do anything. I don't feel like I did anything.
But even the older stuff can refine and get better.
It can get better. But without that feeling of like, ooh, I had a new thought, I feel like, yeah, wow, I didn't create anything new. I just rearranged some words.
Mm-hmm.
I need that. It's just everyone has their own style and system. I get bored. That's why I stopped doing theater. It's because even when I did my play, I got so bored of doing the same thing every night.
Uh-huh.
This is why even part of me like does love crowd work, because I'm like, oh, it does mean that I am surprised. I get to do a little bit of improv. That's cool.
Yeah.
You don't get to do that in theater.
But a comedy special is basically like theater, where it is like beginning, middle, end, like everything is ironed out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And maybe I think I'm too much of a perfectionist to be like to do a lot of loosey-goosey or do crowd work in a special is crazy to me, unless I was filming at least four.
Yeah,
maybe
so you have the coverage
shows,
to, yeah.
But you got to have Sam real money to film. I forget, for his Netflix, I think he filmed 6 or 8.
Oh, did he?
I believe so, yes.
Well, he left crowd work in it. I did notice that.
I know.
There was crowd work
in it. But that's I'm sure he had the looseness to take that risk.
Yeah.
Because he had so many tapings.
Whoa. Well, all right. Well, we're excited to see that then. Congrats.
Thank you.
Are you cooking up anything else you want
to? Just trying to get people to listen to my fucking podcast, The Downside.
They're not listening?
No, so, I mean,
just
some people are.
You just brought it to JFL. What do you mean?
I know. Listen, I know. I people do listen. I would just like enough that I can start having some ads and make some money.
Well, hey, I've been doing this one for over 7 years, over 400 interviews with comedians, guess how much money we've made? We have water. This is what we've made.
That's more than me.
We have custom water.
Don't rub it in my face. I would kill for some downside water.
This is Georgia spring water, though. This is mountain spring water. But yeah, so yeah, when you figure out monetizing a podcast, let me know, because we're certainly looking to do that for sure.
Are you clipping this up?
We're starting to.
Listen, it's the clips.
Yeah.
More people have seen my clips than will ever listen to my podcast. ever. By a trillion fold. No one wants podcasts. They want 30-second bits. It's the same way that no one wants to read the book. They want to get a synopsis. No one reads the articles of The Onion. They read the headline. So I don't even watch movies anymore. I watch the trailer. And I go, that was a great movie.
You got it. Yeah.
Oh my God. It's 2.5 minutes. Oh, it's a long one. I miss when trailers were under 2 minutes.
Well, what would be tell the people, what's the trailer for this show? Why should they listen to Hot Breath?
Your whole podcast or just my episode?
Maybe your episode. That's fine.
Listen to my episode of Hot Breath, because I'm telling you the downsides, tied into my podcast, of stand-up. I'm not putting on a little bow. I'm not going like, well, let's say you do this, it'll all work out. Sometimes it's bad. It's bad, and it's constantly changing your ability to fine tune and your audiences. And what was the challenge when I was at a shit club in LOL where they might not get certain jokes and they might want a certain level? That was a challenge. Now I have a challenge of I'm working with rooms that are there for me and are overly generous and doesn't allow me to see where I'm actually weak. And I have to find new ways to test in a real space. Stand-up is all about figuring out your tools are always changing. Your tools are the audience's reaction. And it's the most unreliable tool in the world. It's like trying to build a house with a ruler that changes size and dimensions and what the material it's made of. And one day it's a 3-yard ruler. One day it's a slinky. And you still somehow have to use that tool to construct a house that you can live in for an hour. And that's what we talk about on today's episode.
Hot Breath. Gianmarco Cerezi, thanks for being on Hot Breath.
Thank you for having me.
Word.
Hot Breath.
This episode of Hot Breath is sponsored by our Patreon. If any of our content has helped your comedy career, join our Patreon linked in the show notes and get positive comedy karma for life. Probably.